This recording was originally a live conversation which took place at Founders Tap back in May 2022.
Swiss startups or European startups often end up as really great features of big companies we know, and I would like for us to be the big companies and not the features.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
Hey, thank you all so much for joining. I know it's warm, it's beautiful weather, but you chose to be here. So thank you for coming and joining us tonight. Ariana, you're the founder and managing director at Dart Labs. You basically run an accelerator. You invest in companies in Switzerland, but also in other geographical areas, and actually bring them to Silicon Valley, to the US, to scale there. First of all, how do you actually balance not only the time difference, but also, of course, the fairly different ecosystems between the United States and Switzerland on a daily basis?
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here and see so many of you here. That's a great question. It's a challenge sometimes. First of all, it's good to understand both cultures and the differences, and then context switching, or as I call it, switching masks, like, or hats, like which mask am I wearing or which hat am I wearing? And my U.S. colleagues often make fun because when I talk to startups, I'll be pitching all the U.S. stuff, like you need to think big and we need to talk about traction, not about revenue. And then I'll talk to my team and I'm like, no, your ideas are crazy. We cannot raise 40 million. Let's start with 10. So I'm always taking both roles. So it's a lot of context switching and split personality sometimes.
And in that regard, what would you say surprises Swiss founders the most when they actually come to the US and really experience the ecosystem there?
Besides the temperatures, it is not warm in San Francisco. So you can always identify the tourists by shorts and shivering. But besides the temperature, it's probably how flat the hierarchies are. You can just approach pretty much anybody, and we're not so used to that, or at least I wasn't so used to that. I used to work for Swisscom for a very long time, so I was on a corporate track, and you don't just walk up to the CEO and be like, hey, I'm so-and-so, this is what I'm working on, what do you think? But there, that's actually really quite possible. And with that, things move faster, and you can really get a lot done in 2 or 3 weeks.
And on the other hand, what surprises the American investors or startups when they do business with Swiss people?
Right. They're not surprised about our precision and punctuality, that they already heard about us. I think what maybe sometimes surprises them is how modest we are. We're very modest. We don't want to sell anything that we don't yet have. Americans are quite different. They'll sell the idea and the dream. And so sometimes when we are modest, they think, oh, there's not much there. And they need to understand that we're just not great at selling what we have, but there's probably more there than we're telling them. Where with the Americans, it's usually quite the opposite.
So we're basically underselling and they're overselling.
Yes, very much so.
So before we actually start talking about the fundraising, one of the most important topics for every founder, save your questions because you will have an opportunity to ask them at the end. So write them down or memorize them in your head. We want to get all of them answered. So the first question you actually have to ask yourself before you actually start fundraising is my company a VC backable company? Should I actually go for investors or not? Right. How do you answer this question?
I think it comes down to how fast and big are you willing to scale and grow? Sort of the simple math that everybody uses is, does each investment have the potential to return my entire fund? Right? We're assuming that half of the investments we make are probably not going to make it. And so you're looking for those one or two who will make the whole difference. So are you willing to grow your valuation 2 to 3x every 12 to 18 months? I think that's kind of the question, because that's what it takes to make a VC happy. And that doesn't by no way, shape, or form mean that's the right way to do it. That's just if you're asking, what is it for VC, then that's what it is.
Yeah, you need to know what you sign up for, right? Because that's what is basically being asked from
yes.
you.
Yes. So I missed the last founder's tap, but usually when I see somebody who has raised such a successful round, my question is, are you relieved or stressed the fuck out? Because the KPIs that come with it and the short timeline is, that's not easy.
It's up or out, basically.
Yeah.
What's the multiple that you look at from an investor perspective in your case? Like, do you say we need to have at least a 10x return on our investment, or what's the threshold there that you look at?
It's always a little bit of an internal struggle. The metrics that we are currently using is 50 million, which means within 5 years, do you have the potential to exit for 50 million plus or have 50 million of revenue plus? But that's a very simple guideline, sort of.
Yeah, I like simple. I think it's easier to follow. You also can choose between traditional VCs, so usually larger funds, or also business angels. Mm-hmm. When would you recommend to go for one of the two?
I think that's largely driven by stage. And I mean, all the answers I'm given are a bit generic. There's a lot of outliers in VC. There's not a lot of standard, especially in Switzerland. But usually during a pre-seed round, there'll be mostly angels. Maybe you'll find a VC. There's not a lot who do pre-seed. I think Wingman is a great example and of an awesome VC who doesn't only just go in pre-seed, but also leads with a good chunk of money. But usually pre-seed, it's mostly angels. Then your seed round might be a mixed bag. You'll still have a couple of angels. You'll have maybe two or three VCs. And then as you're going towards A, it will flipping and the angels will come far and few between. Again, with outliers.
Yeah, but I think that's a good guideline to follow. At the same time, of course, ideal scenario if you decide that you want to take on investors mm-hmm. is that the investors find you. Not everybody's in that luxurious situation. Right. So how do you actually reach out and find the right investors for you to potentially pitch to them?
Yeah, that's a really hard one because it bugs me how much time and effort needs to go into fundraising at an early stage, because that's not really good productive time. But you need to go out and network and network and network and network, because the reality is most VCs invest in companies that came through some form of intro. We've made 14 investments in the last 2 years. I checked, 13 came through some form of warm intro or a connection or one of our scouts, or we reached out to them because we saw them somewhere. There's only one that kind of cold reached out to us and came to the investment. And that mostly has to do with the number of inbound requests VCs get. And the way to stand out is to do your homework. And that unfortunately takes a lot of time. And I think on the flip side, what VCs could do, and we're working on our website right now, is to be more clear in what they invest in and what they're looking for. So that makes it easier for startups to target. But to come back to the actual question, how to do it, network. Attend events like this, reach out to people who are speaking. Even if they're not the right investor for you, you might be able to use somebody like me when you're trying to reach just another VC that is connected to me. A lot of the deals that we made came from other VCs because it didn't fit their thesis or because it was too early for them. So we do share deals if it makes sense, but don't just be like, hey, can you intro me to this fund and that person and this person? It needs to be made easy for us. It's not that we're lazy. It's just the amount of requests that come in. It's a lot and it's hard to screen.
Right. So that means like giving you some templates to use, for example, that you just copy paste and slightly adapt.
Yes. The easiest way to get an introduction is if I don't have to do much besides forward it and maybe include one line of personal between me and that other person. Yeah. But ideally, and it shouldn't be too long. It's like, here's the one paragraph why that VC or that person should be talking to this startup. And if you can make a personal reference, do so. I need to talk to you because you invested in this other company. I need to talk to you because at this panel you said this thing and this resonated with me. So if in the first line I read a personal connection, I am so much more likely to go through all the text and to open the pitch deck. But if you start with, I don't know, metaverse, NFT, Web 3.0, I'm like, that's none of the buzzwords that I put on my website. So that's not what I'm looking for. I'm probably not even going to go through the slides because I already... It's like, oh, that doesn't seem to match.
Wonderful recommendations. What else would you recommend there? Do you also include any traction, like we are at this stage revenue-wise or anything else in the intro?
Yes. if you know that that's relevant to the recipient. So if you know that there's a VC who's stage agnostic, then that's not so much of important information in the first email. For me, I only invest in pre-seed and seed. So having one of these keywords will help my attention to keep going. So generally, yeah, you want to find out what is the thesis of the VC, what sector do they invest in, or what stage, and list that as bullet points. We are this, this, and this, so they can scan through and go, yeah, this is exactly what I should be. Right? The goal of this email or the outreach is for the person to get interested, not for them to go, oh, I'm writing a check. That's not gonna happen. But for them to go, oh, I want to jump on a 20-minute or 30-minute call with that founder. That sounds interesting.
This sounds like a B2B sales process from my perspective.
Yeah. Or dating, as Sophie would say, if she was here.
So how many leads should you put in the funnel to then have a successful outcome? I know this is a very debatable question, but at the end, you want to win at least one investor to finance you, probably even 3 to 5 to have a bit of a mix there. So how many top funnel leads should you approach to actually have a successful outcome in the end?
It's such a hard question, because sometimes it's 3 conversations and 2 are good. And then every following on is like, well, we have 60%, we have 70%. There's a little bit of space. And VCs are really such lemmings. FOMO is really the best way to drive a venture capitalist. It's a little sad, but that's, FOMO really works well. What was the initial question?
Sorry. Like how many you should actually approach?
Oh, that's
in
right.
The
number. I see. I don't want to go back to it because I remember last week Pascal Koenig said 100. You should have 100 VCs on your list. And my co-founder Sophie was like, "That sounds like a lot." I'm generally not a fan of reaching out to everybody because it's a small ecosystem and we talk to each other. And if I know that you already talked to 30 other VCs and you don't have any soft commitments, I'm going to assume that it didn't go so well and there's probably a reason. So selecting a few where you think they're really well aligned. So go after your potential leads first and try to secure that one that fits best, and then the other ones are going to be easier. But if you're starting somewhere, you're going to have a lot of conversations with people who are like, "That doesn't. I'm already tapped out. If I'm an angel, I don't invest in this space. This is too late, too early." And you'll get tired, and also will hear that you're everywhere. You need to have a long list, but really only reach out to the ones that are 100% match in the beginning, and then expand if you need to from there on.
Yeah, so if that's 70 or 100 where you see a really good fit, no matter what the number is, focus on the fit.
If there's a there's nobody who has 100 VCs that are a perfect fit. Show me that startup.
I wish.
No, don't reach out to 100. Yeah. But you expect to have 50 or 60 emails sent in the first couple of weeks.
Okay. And then you also mentioned FOMO, a very important driver to have a successful outcome in the end.
Yeah.
And that usually starts with the very first commitment, right?
Yeah.
How do you get that? How can you really get that first check or term sheet that you can then go shopping with and also convince the other potential investors?
Yeah, it's a really hard chicken egg problem. The first check is by far the hardest. How do you convince that first one where you don't have any time pressure or little time pressure? What I've seen with our portfolio company work well and be successful at times is if you have any important milestones coming up that could be good inflection points for your valuation. So, for example, we've invested in a startup that is just filing patents now, and they are missing about 200 more cases. So the conversation now is we're filing these patents next week, and then the next time you go fundraise in September, there will be a higher valuation because of the patent. So if there is anything, it might not be related directly to fundraising, but anything in your timeline that's an inflection point, try to structure your fundraising timeline around that and then communicate that. That being said, be very careful with communicating hard artificial deadlines because it makes it really hard to then go back to that investor again and say, yeah, I told you the end of March, you need to make a decision, and now it's April, and would you still consider us? So if you're very aggressive about this is how much time you have, it could backfire on you. But do communicate a clear timeline and have a timeline for yourself. Like the first 2 weeks is for initial outreaches. The second 2 weeks is for follow-up calls. The third, and communicate that. I don't know if it works on everybody, but it works on me. I fall for deadlines.
I mean,
all the time.
You have to act then, absolutely. How long does that fundraising process actually take on an average basis? I know it depends on the case, etc., but on average, how long should you actually allocate to close from first outreach until you have the funds in your bank account?
Yeah, that probably also depends a little bit on round. And for example, if you're doing a few convertible notes in the beginning, or if you're doing a priced round. I think at the pre-seed level, I'm totally okay with getting convertible notes over the span of 18 months. And maybe it's two, and then it's a couple of months, and it's another two or three, and you're not spending a huge amount of time on the process, but they're trickling in, and the valuation should go up a little bit each time, half a million, maybe a million, depending on what you've reached in the meantime. So there, it's okay for it to be drawn out. When you're doing a priced round, of course, you cannot draw it out. You need everybody to pay and sign more or less at the same time. Otherwise, you're not going to get your money until everybody paid in. And there, most of the time, if it's a quick round, it will be 4 to 6 months from I started outreach to I'm signing. And even if you are quick in convincing investors, the whole due diligence process takes a while. And what usually takes much longer than people expect is negotiating on sometimes random terms, especially if you have a few angels involved and then everybody wants to say something about how long should the maturity date be or whatnot. That sometimes eats up suddenly a month or two. That wasn't expected. But a fast round is 4 to 6 months. Often it's 6 to 9 months. After 9 months, we're starting to get concerned probably.
But I think that really shows all the founders out there that this is a time-consuming task.
Yes.
So be prepared for that.
Yes. If anybody says on the timeline, 6 months and our runway, like we allotted 6 months for fundraising and our runway is 7 months, I'm like already...
it's going to be tight.
It's going to, yeah. This is not going to be easy.
Then you mentioned the intro call as the, goal after your first initial outreach or ideally the warm introduction. What happens in that introduction call? What do you talk about? What's the goal of that first intro call?
For me personally, it's getting a feel for the founder and for the company, for the team, and at the end for the market that they're trying to go after. For us, it's usually pre-product market fit. It's founder market. Do we think this is the team that can tackle this challenge? And is it a challenge that is worth tackling and right. scaling like that? But I'd say that's kind of the filter. And then as we're going on in the conversation, it's going to become more concrete and I want to know exactly what's the business model and what does your sales pipeline look like and all this stuff. But the first conversation for me is, I think, more focused on the person and the mission.
At such an early stage, it's hard, very difficult to have a hard science behind the decision-making process.
Yeah.
So what is like hard science where you really do follow your rating sheet or anything of that sort? And how much of the final decision is actually gut feeling from an investor's perspective?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we write up a 14-page usually report, going through section, like what's the business model? What do we think about it? What is the competition? What do we think about it? We usually use thumbs up and down and fingers crossed, which our RNC committee loves. It's easy visually to see where we stand. So we don't use any numbers or any scoring in that sense. It's gut feel as long as it makes sense. But there is really no... We started with an Excel sheet and with numbers, and we've completely gone away from that. And we do heavily rely on our experts. We're really generalists in our team. And then part of the due diligence for us is always involving two experts, usually somebody from the technical side, somebody from the market that they want to go into. To validate, and then if they love it and we love it and RIC says, let's go.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So you had the intro call. What happens afterwards? You said that then you do a more deep dive analysis.
Yeah.
you do that with or without the startup? What's the process then?
Yeah. So for us, it's an intro call, usually 30 to 45 minutes. And then the next step is a call with our whole team. So our US partners, Doug and Sophie, participate. We do have startups pitch twice. So they do pitch once to me and then once again to the whole team, but it's a 10-minute pitch, or 10 to 15 minutes. We're not like timing. It's not that type of pitch. And the reason we do that is, as an accelerator, we work for 12 months with those founders. And it's really important for us to hear how they present a company, and also to see how big is the gap between the pitch today and where we would need to be to pitch in the US. Because that's kind of the lens we're of course evaluating everything with. And then after that, it's the two experts. So that comes right after the team. And then due diligence, which means going into the data room and trying to figure out all the details in a sense, and also with our legal partner for the legal due diligence, so looking at the contracts, looking at the shareholder agreement, trying to see if there's a lever agreement or suggesting one. If not, we also leave the startup with a lot of recommendations that are not relevant to us. We work with Michi Bayer from Menger & Fieli, who's very startup and friendly, and he will also give us red flags that are not relevant to us as an investor, but relevant to the startup. Mm-hmm. So our work actually already starts in during that process. And often the experts that we involve end up somehow involving themselves with the startup. Because again, if they love it, we love it. And then they also want to continue the relationship. Sometimes they become advisors. We've had an expert invest and become a member of the board before. And then after that part is just the IC committee. For us, that's very simple because it's me and two other shareholders. We meet on an ad hoc basis, so it's not some date that needs to be matched. But we
no
just
artificial
organize.
Deadlines.
No, we organize around the cases that we have.
And there you make the final decision whether you invest or not.
Yes, the IC has the final decision. So two out of the three need to say yes for it to go through. And this process can take, I think the fastest was 2.5 weeks. And there we co-invested alongside a lead we knew. So a lot of the due diligence, we just adopted their what they had come up with. And the longest was 8 months. And that's mostly because the IP was stuck in the startup was stuck in negotiations with the college on IP transfer, and we couldn't invest until that was clear. And then as soon as that was cleared up, we went through. But usually, I would say it's 4 to 6 weeks from first conversation to checks being signed.
Great. Yeah. And I also want to focus a bit on the documents that you mentioned before. So first, you have the pitch deck that you usually already receive with the email introduction. From your investor's perspective, what makes a good pitch deck? What gets your attention?
I personally like the Silicon Valley 10 slides problem solution. Just because it's so common now that my brain's already expecting that storyline in a sense, and it's more efficient if it's in that storyline. And then if it's really deep tech or from the health space, have your scientific research ready. I quickly want to be able to see what that looks like or what that came from. And then for the data room, SickTick, I think, has a great list on what what you should consider putting in your data room. But the earlier it is, the emptier that data room. Definitely if you have any LOIs, any contracts, if you have a good, strong sales funnel, put that in there. A lot of startups, for some reason, don't put that in there, but they always tell you in a pitch about all these great companies they're talking to. So it's, yeah.
Again, we are underselling here in Switzerland.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
In some cases, yeah.
Q&A, or frequently asked questions. What I find very helpful, sometimes it's in a data room, they'll put a document with all the questions other VCs have asked that they have answered.
Great.
Because a lot of us have the same questions going through the data room, and that saves a lot of back and forth between me and the founders.
Right.
Because if I have questions, I'll first go to the FAQs and see, is it already there? And sometimes it is.
That's a very great idea to speed up the process.
Yes.
Then sometimes you also, the startup comes to you and asks to sign an NDA. Mm-hmm. You do that or you laugh at this?
I do it. Some VCs don't do it. I chuckle, but I do it for the. I do it because I know it's, as Michi said, is not worth the paper it's written on. So I'm also the same way. I don't think it has much validity. The same way I'm not worried about signing it. So if it makes the startup more comfortable, I will sign it. And I know at an early stage that is something that. I've once had a startup, they didn't want to share their pitch deck until I signed an NDA. I was like, okay, you're going a bit too far, but fine, I'm curious now.
Was like, it worth what? It?
No. I mean, no, it was a good, it was a good startup, but the pitch deck was, I did not see why I had to sign an NDA. But it had one client, they had a good client and it had, the logo was on it. I'm like, just remove the logo next time and then say it in a conversation and prove it in a data room later, but... Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. Now, if you're in the process, so you had the due diligence taking place, but you still haven't received the final commitment. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are investors that say, oh yeah, we are so interested to invest in your company, but actually they are not. So how do you deal with them? How do you bring them to a commitment, whether it's good or bad, but you just want to know where you stand as a startup?
That's a really tough one because sometimes they drag their feet. A common one is come back when you have a lead. And some won't start the due diligence until you have a lead. And then that really sucks because it draws out the process and it's hard for you to say where you stand on soft commitments. How do you move them along? I mean, the easiest thing is having a lead and having a signing date. And I also find it absolutely okay to just ask and be upfront and say, we're in the middle of the process. I'm talking to a couple of VCs. I would really like to know what our timeline looks like. Can you tell me where you're at? They'll at the most be embarrassed at their bad communication.
Yeah. But I think that's a good tip because very often we don't really dare to ask that question. I think we should because we are as founders driving the process.
Yes. That's yes. Important. And it also shows that you're in charge and also follow up. We had one founder in our portfolio that was really bad at following up. It's like, they're not interested. You need three more emails. They might be interested. Yeah. They're just busy and you're not coming through strong. And especially if you're, this is really important if you're dealing with US VCs mm-hmm. because Americans are super aggressive on follow-ups and very charming at times. And sometimes their emails are quite funny.
That's right.
Sometimes I'm laughing, I'm not responding. But they're like, my favorite one was like, hey, this is my fifth email to you. Here's a quick ABCA. I'm out of my mind and I haven't done my homework. B, you're out of your mind and you're so busy that this is never going to be anything. And C, I don't know, whatever it was. Yeah. It's just not a match. It was then much easier to just write back a letter, send back A, B, or C. And you know that it's okay. No, they're not going to be mad. They're just glad to finally know, okay, you're not interested. I can cross you off my list.
Absolutely.
So again, make it easy for VCs to answer because apparently we need that.
It really is the sales process over and over again. The money lies in the follow-up.
Yes.
Now, you could also be in the complete other position, right? Where you actually have multiple offers or term sheets from VCs, ideally, and then you have to make a choice. So how does your choice also affect your reputation as a founder? What should you look or watch out for to make the right decision?
I mean, the VC ecosystem is a small ecosystem. And just like every ecosystem, it has some bad apples. And we all know who they are because it's a small ecosystem. So I will periodically see one of the bad apples in conversation. And then I'll take that founder aside and say, you did not hear this from me. Here's a couple of anecdotes as of why I would not work with this VC. But I don't think that reputation is the biggest problem when choosing a bad VC, right? A bad investor on your cap table or in your board can make life really difficult, and reputation is probably the least of the issues. And then when comparing the term sheets, definitely get some support from somebody who has looked at term sheets before, because the devil is in the details. Don't just be like, this is the highest valuation, I'm going with this one. They really need to be modeled out because depending on some of the terms, what seems the most obviously best deal might not be the best deal. So get some advice from somebody who understands term sheets or has gotten some before. Sit down and compare line by line and not just on valuation, because that's what we usually focus on.
And what are some terms that you really should watch out for there? Is it like liquidation preference, or what are some key focus areas that you absolutely have to pay attention to?
That's really difficult to say, because sometimes, you know, a convertible note or a term sheet will be 2 or 3 pages. And sometimes it's 40 pages and there's 30 pages that I've never heard about. So definitely be careful if it's really long. Liquidation preference that you mentioned is a big one. Just remember 1x non-participating is what you want to see. But I think that's also become more or less, I don't dare say standard with anything that we do here, but common maybe is a good word. Pay attention to board seats early on. You don't want to be a pre-seed startup with 5 investors on your board. That's not a good idea. Also, be careful with investors who are pushing for that early on. It tells you something about their understanding of your stage. Information rights, maybe something to pay attention early on. If you have strategic investors, there you want to be careful in information rights. So you want to make sure that they don't know too much about the company if you're too close to their core business. It's get somebody like Michi Bayer. This is the third time I mentioned him. I really like him. He's been our lawyer for 4 years, but I do not get any kickbacks.
Just a good work relationship. Yeah, he delivers.
He delivers. He does.
Then, of course, the other thing that you need to reach an agreement before you can actually sign the deal is the valuation, right? If you do a priced round.
Yeah.
So how does that negotiation go? Because usually the startup has an idea how much the company's worth, and that doesn't necessarily correspond with the investor's perspective.
Yeah, it's always a weird dance. It's always a weird dance from founders that come in way too high to founders that don't want to name a number. At pre-seed, the valuations are mostly based on comparables. Really, the best guess is what are other startups similar to you? What have they raised recently? Also, I would say pre-seed in Switzerland is most of the time between 2 and 4 million, 2 and 5 million, somewhere in that range. And it depends a little bit on how rockstar your team is and if you have any IP. And maybe you have a good pipeline already. Maybe you have a couple of LOIs, but we're pre-seed, so there's not like, and then seeds, we're somewhere between 4 and 8. Sometimes they're pushing 10. It depends again a little bit. So are you a deep tech startup or a SaaS startup who already has revenue? But it's, I've never used a formula to determine a valuation. It's always been looking left and right, looking in our portfolio, looking at the conversations we had. And then also, I usually ask the startup. Seldomly the first fund they're talking to. We don't lead most of the time. We do sometimes, but it's not like Wingman who always does the lead. So we mostly want to know, you know, what have others told you? What kind of term sheets did you get? And most of the time we'll follow. If there's a term sheet, we're not going to issue a counter term sheet. We'll either go, that works out, or it won't. And I've never seen a term sheet where it was like, oh, somebody... Actually, I did once. I did. There was a pre-seed startup that had a 9 million valuation and they had nothing. And it was B2B SaaS, a chatbot attached to Slack, doing some coaching. And I'm like, no.
Not going to happen.
And also, not because, oh my God, you're so not worth 9 million, but how is this going to work out? So you're going to have to raise again in 12 months. 2 to 3x is what I want to see. Tell me how we're going to make that happen. Like what value can we generate in the next 18 months for the next valuation to be 25 or 30 million? So it's not going to work out.
Right. I think that's something really important to keep in mind, that if you raise money, you do have to deliver the 2 to 3 times valuation growth
in 12 to 18 months.
Exactly. Otherwise, you get into trouble.
Yes.
So keep that in mind. That's really, really important and often gets forgotten.
Yeah, that brings me to the point of how much you give away, right? Yeah. If
you can read my mind.
It's how we set valuations, right? Valuations when I'm talking to founders are also fluctuating because they're like, well, I was looking for 1 million, but now I'm looking for 2 and I don't want to get diluted more, so the valuation has gone up. So it's a determining factor for valuations as well. Do you want to give away 15 to 25? Ideally not 25. I'm more 15 to 20 each round. And so where does that put you? How much money are you looking for? How much do you have to give away? And sometimes that's just how we calculate the valuation.
Yeah, makes sense, because then that's more of the founder's perspective, the company's perspective.
Yeah.
And it's easier to reach a fair price tag that way. Because in the end, it's also your interest as an investor to have that in the right ballpark.
Yes. My interest as an investor is that 7 or 8 years from now, you have an amazing exit. And so I'm sometimes a bit confused that other VCs don't think so long term. Sometimes we see them negotiate really hard on a lot of terms at like a seed round. I'm like, dude, the next like big VC that's coming in with $5 million is just going to erase all of these negotiations and we're all going to be forced to sign common stock. Like that's another thing I learned. There's for us not much, it's not worth negotiating on a lot of the terms because we're probably going to have to give up most of it when right. the big guys come in anyway.
Yeah.
So long-term perspective.
Yeah. Focus on what's really important and don't worry about the other stuff.
That's easier said than done, but yeah.
I can imagine, yeah. Now, let's imagine that we successfully closed the round. Usually you say, you know, after the round is before the round. Yeah. So when should you actually ideally start with the next fundraising round to start the whole process there?
I mean, it depends on how long your runway is. Ideally, you have 6 to 9 months of a break before you have to start planning and reaching out again.
So that means roughly 1.5 to 2 years of runway that you should raise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's painful, but yes.
It is, yeah. Now, if you look at the current markets, you know, valuations are dropping, multiples are plummeting.
Right.
What do you think will happen over the next few months? I know nobody can predict the future, but do you think it will get significantly harder for startups also in pre-seed and seed stage to raise money? Mm-hmm. Or won't they be affected too much because the funds, they still have the money that they raised in the past, they still have to deploy the funds?
Yeah, it really depends where you stand. And I'm not a huge fan of the letter YC has sent out, for example, because to me, everything that's happening is about confidence. And when somebody who has huge signal strength like YC, which is a pillar in the community that a lot of people and investors look to, and the message they send out is nobody's going to be able to fundraise or exit in the next 24 months. All of you should have a 24-month runway, which no early stage startup has a 24-month runway. So that then immediately tells all the other investors, oh. So they sent a clear signal with that letter. And apparently it's already been felt. I talked to 2 startups earlier today that are fundraising that said we had angels that committed that pulled out and we had a couple other angels that reduced their check size. So it's already being felt. I know of later stage startups that were in the midst of raising a C round that completely fell apart to the point where the company might fall apart. So it's really bad at the moment. That being said, that letter reminded me a lot of 2 years ago, right? When the pandemic started, there was the same uncertainty. And at the end, the last 2 years have been amazing for VC, right? Record years. Not to say that this is also going to be a blip of a couple of months, because I think things are compounding, right? Corona has not fully gone away. There is now war. So there's more uncertainty. It could be longer than last time. But I, on my end, or the way we're investing right now, is not changing. Again, investing at pre-seed evaluations between 2 and 5 million, we're not like, what should we push that down to? That doesn't make any sense. So we're staying steady. And then we'll see next year. At some point, we'll also have to fundraise. And then we'll see what the landscape is like. The positive news is that there has been a couple of funds that freshly raised money in Swiss funds. Last year, there was 3, 4, 5 new funds that have topped up. And for them, this is great. They haven't written a lot of tickets. So everybody who has a large portfolio is now worried about their portfolio. They're going to be allocating more money to save the current portfolio, assuming they'll have a harder time raising out in the open market. But all the funds have made 1 or 2 investments so far. They're happy because they're expecting to buy cheap over the next couple of years. And they're probably also going to be the valuations will drop because most likely because of those guys. Yeah.
I mean, at the same time, it can also be a huge chance to really scale your company these days, because war for talent is decreasing. Big companies like Klarna are laying off people like big time.
Yeah.
Your competitors might not be able to actually raise funds or not as much money as they used to raise in the past.
Yeah.
So this could also be a very, very good moment to be an entrepreneur today.
Depends on where you stand and what your bank account looks like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Exciting times ahead of us.
Always. And crisis times have always made for great entrepreneurs. Yep. Unfortunately, it's always so easy to say like, crisis coming. Lots of innovation. It's messed up. But that's
absolutely
what happens.
So Ariana, before we open for questions from the audience, I have a few rapid fire questions prepared for you. Just to wrap up today's conversation. So I either give you different options to choose from or a simple question you have to answer in one sentence.
Okay.
You're ready?
Yeah.
So the first one, founder or investor?
Fuck. Founder.
Why? Because you're an investor today.
I'm a founder too.
True.
I had to figure out how to come up with a business model that sustains a fund with only 5 million. Founder, because I love the challenge. And I never wanted to be a VC. I wanted to be an accelerator. But unfortunately, you need money everywhere to make an impact. That's how we became a VC.
Next one, bootstrapping or VC money? I gave you all the difficult choices today.
VC money, accelerator money.
Okay, of course. Next one, early and small exit or big and late exit?
What? Big and late exit. Big and late exit because it irks me sometimes that Swiss startups or European startups often end up as really great features of big companies we know. And I would like for us to be the big companies and not the features.
But you did have an early exit, right?
We did.
Which is also not bad for the fund, but...
No, it was, you know, personally for us, of course, it was great.
Because sure.
It was in our second year and it made our fundraising then easier. And it also makes our startup scouting easier. Actually, Way has been... they've been great helpers in filling up pipeline with other cool startups.
And if you had to choose an exit option, IPO or trade sale?
Oh man, that depends. Really depends on the situation.
No hard choice.
Let's say IPO.
Okay.
For fun, because it happens less often.
And the last one for you today, San Francisco or Zurich?
Zurich.
Easy choice.
That was an easy choice. Okay. And I lived in San Francisco for many years, but clearly
you're back here
Zurich.
Now.
I'm here by choice.
Absolutely. Ariana, it was a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much for taking the time and lots of great investments in the near future. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.